Welcome. My name is Jeannie Olson, and the name of this class is Grief and Loss, A Time to Mourn and a Time to Dance. I put this up here. I hope most of you have had a chance to read it. What is the big white elephant, obviously, in the middle of the room?
Death.
Death and grief and mourning. And we find, especially in our American society, that we really don't like to talk about grief and death. And so first thing I do is commend you for coming, because this isn't a topic that's easy to talk about, and we're too often like the folks in this room. The elephant's there, and we can look around it and we can pretend like it's not there, but it is there, and we need to know how to face that elephant in the room. If any of you didn't get a chance to read this, I'll give it to you later and you can have a chance to look at it. The elephant in the room is the death of a spouse. It's the suicide of our friend. It's the death of a newborn that's never taken a breath. It's grief, it's loss. There are 8 million people this year in America who will face the death of an immediate family member. Now, I'm just talking about the death of a loved one. And we know, and we're going to talk about later, we're going to fill in that grief pie. There's a lot of other griefs in the world besides the death of a loved one. But that's just the death of a loved one. 8 million people are going to be affected. And of course, our society is very death-denying. We try very hard to look young. We try very hard to stay alive. When finally someone does die in our family, what do we do but pad the language so it doesn't sound so bad? They've passed on. They've gone on a journey. And sometimes, unfortunately, we even use the metaphor of sleeping, moving into the next world. In the hospital where I'm a lay chaplain, they use the word expired, kind of like a driver's license, you know? You expire. Or you lost someone. Can you imagine what it's like for a four-year-old to a four-year-old and say, well, we lost Cousin Kate. Well, just go find Cousin Kate. You know, we use terminology that confuses our children, gives them fantasies worse than the actuality, by padding the language instead of being honest and direct. And that's one of the things I'll try and touch on, because I think we as educators and we as parents don't know how to talk to our kids about death. So we tell our children half-truths and use language that's inappropriate. And mostly we do that because of our own fears and our own inability to handle death and deal with it directly. I'm going to start out with three stories. And the three stories illustrate the way some people have inappropriately and in denial handle death situations, and therefore we get, this is a pesky fly, we get grief that's unresolved. The first story happened in our home. My husband and my father-in-law were in the den, and I was out cleaning the hallway right outside the den. Now, I had known my husband and father-in-law for 19 years, and I had never heard this conversation. It went like this. My father-in-law said, well, it's been 34 years since your brother was killed. And my husband said, yes, it is October 3rd, isn't it? And then my father-in-law went on to say something that I had never heard. He said, you know, some say that wasn't an accident. Now, to give you the background, my husband was 10 when his 14-year-old brother was killed in a hunting accident. And he went on to say, some people say that wasn't an accident. And if I wanted to know the truth about the whole shooting, I should have gone to see the man who runs the bait and tackle shop in Elk River, and he could have told me the whole story. I stood frozen in the hallway, just frozen. And I heard my father-in-law go on to say, but what good would it do? What would it have changed if I would have gone? And I'm stating today that if you're still asking the questions 34 years later, that maybe that is an unresolved grief. And he could have proceeded with his grief and his healing a lot better if he'd have gone to the man in Elk River and asked the questions. My in-laws and my parents are full-blooded Norwegian. Now I feel, yes, thank you. Now, I almost entitled this class, grief and loss, the problem with being Scandinavian. Because those of you who are Scandinavian, I see shaking your heads. You know, how do we go through grief? If you're German, you're not left out. How do we go through it? We shed a few tears, and mostly not in public, right? And then we are brave, and we're stoic, and we pick ourselves up, and we go on. We do not make this a public thing. We also hear for the second illustration that time heals. As was said in the introduction, when Ron was introducing me, I do grief counseling. And a woman came to my office several years ago, and her husband had died. She was young. She had a 7-year-old daughter. She came to my office and she said, "I've been in my house for 1 year. I left only to go to my child's conferences at school," since she's 7 years old. And I don't know how she got groceries. She didn't say. But she said, "I thought time healed. And I'm here to tell you that I haven't healed one bit. And in fact, I'm in worse shape than I was a year ago when my husband died." Time doesn't heal. It's what we do with our time that helps and perpetuates the healing process. The third story. A woman came who is in charge of Compassionate Friends. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's a support group for parents whose children have died. She needed to bring me some brochures that I could pass out in a grief recovery group. She could have put them in the mail, but she didn't. She came to my office. And then she seemed to sort of hang around. So I invited her in, asked her to sit down, and could tell that she needed to talk. And I said, "Why are you a member of Compassionate Friends?" And she said, "I had 2 children who were on a motorcycle just going around the block." And she said, "They were killed instantaneously." She said, "It's been 7 years. And then she went on to say, she said, "What I'm going to tell you, you're going to think that I'm crazy." And I said, "I can bet you that I'm not going to say you're crazy, because most people who are in grief at some time, we'll talk about this too, think that they are crazy." She said, "I didn't get to see my children. The mortician thought they were in too bad a shape for me to see them. And so my husband got to see them, but I didn't." And she said, and then she put her head down and she said, "And sometimes I think that maybe those weren't my children. That maybe they were somebody else's children. My children are out there someplace." She said, "I know that's crazy, because I know that that really is them, but I didn't get to see them dead." In this case, it's somebody else who hindered her grief process. We as parents, maybe we can't handle seeing our child who's mangled too much by their death, or a loved one, any loved one. But we know as parents what that little kid's hand looked like, and we know what that foot looked like when we put the Band-Aid on it this morning, and we know what their hair feels like. If any of you get yourself in a situation like this, please remember this. Your healing starts when you see that person dead. Now that's hard, that's horrible, and it's difficult for you to have to see that. But believe me, that's when the whole process starts, because then you believe, yes, they're really gone. So we can hinder ourselves, like my father-in-law and this woman who stayed in the house thinking time would heal, or someone else can hinder our grief process. I say this, and I begin with this, because unresolved grief does happen. It does happen. 20% at least, and I think this is a low figure, but 20% of people who go for mental health to someone for their mental health with a problem, their problem can be traced back to an unresolved grief issue. There's a chaplain that I work with who goes over to a different hospital and does work in a drug and alcohol abuse center. And when he goes around the room and talks to the folks who are there for their abuse problems, he asks them to trace back when they started drinking or abusing drugs. And he doesn't have a statistic, but he said, "As I go around the room, I'd say more than half of them can trace that back to a time in their life when they were in the process of going through a grief or loss. And how did they handle it? They started to drink, because that controlled the pain," they thought. Granger Westberg, who is, of course, is kind of a pioneer in this field, and he's written a wonderful book called Good Grief. Just a little bitty book, but it's a wonderful book to send somebody who's lost someone. He's really a pioneer. And I went to a workshop with him this this winter down in Texas, and he's a hospital chaplain also. And he said, among other things, he said 1/3 of the people who are in a hospital with a major illness are also working on a grief issue. And that's a pretty high statistic. Okay, why do I tell you all this? First of all, I can't stress enough how important it is that we, for ourselves and our own mental health, learn about grief and how to deal with it. And number two, that we work on it when we're in it and we don't just ignore it. And number three, that whether we're parents or whether we're teachers, that we teach kids in little things how to deal with grief so that when the big things come along, they have the tools to handle it. Okay, all that's an introduction. Already, you can see I've choked up on this subject. So I'm here to say, I know some of you are going through a grief or loss. You're in a time of mourning in your life, and you may feel this lump well up in your throat like I did a few minutes ago, and you may feel tears coming into your eyes, and I'm here to say that's okay. To affirm that, I have even brought you Kleenex. And I will just toss it to whoever needs it, or you can come up and get it, because I want to say that tears are okay, and I'm asking you not to leave, because maybe, you'll glean something from this talk that will help you with your grief process, and maybe the next person next to you can just put their hand on you, but if you just start crying, that's okay too. That's okay. You know, we're all in the same boat, right? We've either been through a major grief or loss, or we're in the middle of one now, or we're going to be in one. So we're all here together. Let's define, first of all, grief and loss. So far, I've only talked about death. That is only one of how many? Hundreds. Help me. Griefs and losses.
Divorce.
Divorce. Thank you. Another one.
Loss of a pet.
Pet. Great.
Moving.
Excuse me.
Moving.
Moving. Oh, yes.
Job loss.
Job loss. Good.
Empty nest.
Right.
Disabled child.
Keep going.
Chronic illness.
Excuse me?
Chronic illness.
Right. I see that every day. Go on.
Friendships.
Friendships. Broken friendships. People who move.
The loss of a family member to drugs or alcohol.
Okay.
Not in death, but just
but you've
to
lost
control.
Them because they're not the person that they were before. Whoever said that. Right.
Job change.
Excuse me? We've got that. Job change or losing a job, either one. Anything else? How about a fire? Lose your home? That, right. Okay, anything else? Okay, we got a pretty good list. There's others we could add. Maybe we'll go on. Even having a new baby or a blended family. You get a lot of grief issues in that. Retirement. I know I watched my father go through retirement. Hard, definitely a grief. He didn't want to do that. How about loss of, we said loss of job, loss of income, no matter how it is, whether it's any number of ways. How about a midlife crisis? All of a sudden we're realizing that we're 44 years old and my life is half over with and I haven't done everything I wanted to do. All sorts of things. Okay, you've got that. Granger Westberg also talked, and I had never heard him do this before, about small, medium, and large losses. And how, no matter what the size of the loss, we sort of go through the same process. A small grief would be, for example, if our wallet or purse was stolen or lost. Some of you have been through that. You know, you go through the same sort of process, it's just less intensified. And he said that takes from 3 days to 3 weeks to go through a small loss. Medium loss would be, for example, a car accident, where our car is totaled and we have our arm in a sling and we have to buy a new car and have to go to the chiropractor because our neck hurts. That sort of medium loss would be 3 weeks to 3 months. Then we get into the large losses and those take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years to get through. The small and medium losses, we can put our lives back together and be pretty much the same. We can go back to being kind of the same. The large losses, we're never going to quite be the same, are we? Because we put those pieces back together, we reconstruct our lives, but it's never the same. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is another name I'm sure you probably heard of in her Death and Dying Pioneer. And she talked about stages. The people who have come out with stuff from her lead have used different words, processes that we go through, areas that we go through, because stages look like you kind of go through them and you're done. And we know, and those of you who have been through grief know, you're not done. You know, you go through, it's cyclical, and you go through it again, and you go through it again, and you go through it again. I know you've read probably enough about this in Ann Landers and Reader's Digest and Adult Education's at Church, right? I'm going to go through them and go through them quickly because there's some stuff I want to add to it that I think might be helpful. Of course, the first one would be the shock and denial. It can't possibly be happening. This can't happen to my child. This can't happen to my marriage, and so on. The next one, of course, is bargaining. Oh, if only this isn't true, God, I'll. That's that stage. That is usually pretty quick. This one isn't listed often, but I'm going to list it because I think it's so important, and that's the emotional release that we need during times of grief and loss. And crying is so important. I have three things to say about crying. First of all, gentlemen, I'm mostly speaking to you. And that is, they're saying now, and don't make me quote some study because I don't have it, Granger Westberg just mentioned it, that maybe one of the reasons that you men are dying sooner is that you're not releasing your emotions. Now, thank goodness that's changing. We're not saying to our little boys, don't cry, right? We're allowing that. But to release those emotions and to allow yourself the freedom to cry. I love this story, and it's a true story. This is the second point. There was a woman who just found out her only daughter had been killed, and she was in the emergency room at the hospital. And she was just what we would call sobbing uncontrollably, hysterical, we would call it. And her pastor walked in, and he must not have had too many good courses in this at seminary. But he walked in and patted her on the shoulder and said, what would be the worst thing he could say? There, don't cry. Now, you wouldn't have done that. I can see that right now, that you definitely wouldn't have made that mistake. She stopped crying instantaneously, and she turned to him. This is a true story. And she looked at him, and she said, my only daughter just died, and you are not going to deny me the right to express the way I feel. And she turned around and she proceeded to cry again. Oh, yay! You know, yay! She needed to feel what she was feeling, and she wasn't embarrassed by doing that. Bless her heart. The other thing is, and God is such a neat, wonderful creator, and this is the third thing I want to say about tears, is that when God created us, if you're crying because you're cutting onions, this doesn't happen. But if you're crying out of sadness and lonely and despair, there is a chemical that is released in your tears that's a tranquilizer. Isn't that neat? So that when you cry, see, you're gleaning one little bit of information maybe already from this talk, that when you cry and you cry, how do you feel afterwards?
Better.
Better. And one of the reasons is because that chemical has been released in your system that's a tranquilizer. And I just think, ooh, God did a neat thing. I don't know where I heard it. Maybe I even heard it here at Holden. I wish I could give credit where credit is due. But someone said, tears are the last gift God gave us when Adam and Eve left the garden. Isn't that a neat thing? If we realize that tears are a gift, it's a beautiful thing to accept that gift. Okay, next thing is guilt. And usually if there is a death or in any loss, there's some degree, mostly in any of these things, there's some degree of guilt. If only I had. And we go through those. And we blame ourselves and we feel guilty. The thing we have to decide in guilt is it realistic guilt or is it unrealistic guilt? If it's unrealistic guilt, we better shake it off and say, you know, I may feel this way and I may have to work through this, but it isn't my fault. Realistic guilt is a little harder, isn't it? There were two kids at Augustana who were in a car accident, but the driver of the car wasn't killed, and there had been drinking involved by the driver. The Sunday after the college students were killed, and of course the college was definitely affected by this, the college campus pastor got up and he stood in the podium to give his sermon, and he looked over the college students, and he said, and I hope I have this pretty close, Jesus Christ was born and died to forgive sins. And then he sat down. That sermon will never be forgotten because it put it all in a nutshell, what we need to do with realistic guilt. You can come in. So we got it, and there are, you know, making amends, apologies, and so on. Okay, anger. Anger's a biggie in any of these two because we want to blame someone other than ourselves or ourselves. So we're angry at ourselves, we're angry at the disease, we're angry at the drunk driver, we're angry at our ex-spouse, you know, we're angry at the person who fired us. I'll never forget one day, I was on call as a chaplain, and I was called to the emergency room, and a young man had been killed. And the father was there, and he saw my name tag, which said hospital chaplain. And he looked at me with a whole lot of anger, and he said, "So, why did God kill my son? Why did God take my son? It's all God's fault." I want to give you the background of this young man's death. He was riding a motorcycle without a helmet, and he had been drinking, and he ran into the back of a parked truck. But this father was so angry that he had to blame someone in that moment of intense grief. And of course, we know oftentimes God, if we can't blame somebody else, we blame God for that. I've had people come into my office, and I'll say, "Are you ever mad at your spouse, you know, for leaving you?" And I'll never forget one wonderful little woman. She said, "Yep, the only time I'm ever mad at my husband for dying on me is when something happens to the car." But I will say, very much on the serious side, you know, we seem to have our roles in our marriages. And one person does all the bookkeeping, and one person does the laundry and the cooking. And it doesn't matter who has those roles. But I want to tell you, and if it affects one couple, it'll be worth my saying this, is that we can get rid of a whole lot of anger after our spouse dies if we teach them how to do what we do. Do you know how many spouses have said to me, "I don't know how to make a hard-boiled egg," or "I don't know how to cook," or, you know, "She never taught me how to use the washing machine." But on the other side of that, how many widows have come to me and said, "He did all the finances. I didn't know how much money I was going to have to live on. I don't know anything about the insurance papers." Some people have even said to me, "I don't even know how to write a check, to say nothing about balancing the checkbook." Do you know how much anger someone has when they have to deal with that? I think our generation is doing better with job sharing within our marriages. But that isn't always so with the older generation. And if some of you take just this out of this room, teach each other the jobs, because it does help so we're not angry with each other afterwards. Depression and loneliness, I'm of course one of the stages. I'm not going to talk about that too much. Tomorrow at 4:00, anyone who's been or in the midst of a grief or loss within the last couple of years, we're going to do a small group discussion sort of thing over in Narnia East. Won't be taped, more intimate. You'll be doing most of the talking. So we're going to talk about some of this stuff there. But obviously that's a big part of grief, is the depression and the loneliness, the "I don't care, I don't know if I want to live." This is the point where perhaps many people commit suicide, whether slow or fast. Another thing that I really want to talk about, though, is the anxiety and the panic. 40% of people who are going through any kind of grief or loss think they're going crazy. And that's many times why they will come to our office. They'll say, "I really think I'm nuts. I really think I'm ready to go off the edge." Let me show you a cartoon here, which I also like. It doesn't... backwards. I'll read it because it's a little hard to see. The little fellow's looking in the bedroom of his grandmother's bedroom, and he says to his mom, "Grandma's in her room talking again, and there's nobody there." "That's okay, Jeffrey. Some older people talk to themselves at times, and we don't know why, but they do." And there's grandmother talking to her deceased husband, saying, "Remember this shell, dear? We found it on the beach in Florida the year before you died." Well, talking to the deceased loved one is probably the least unusual of things that people say, I'm crazy. It's setting the table for that person. It's one person came to me and said, I know you're going to think I'm nuts. And that's kind of the beginning statement. And this person said, I sleep with my spouse's pajamas because it still has the scent of him. And I said, that is the most wonderful idea. I said, I'm going to remember that. And if Paul dies before I do, I'm going to do that because I think it's a wonderful idea. And she looked at me and she not only knew she wasn't crazy, but she was affirmed in her process of saying goodbye. That scent isn't going to stay there forever. She's not going to be doing this 10 years down the line, but she's doing it now as she moves through saying goodbye. I think a pet is a wonderful thing to have during grief and loss, whether it's divorce or whether it's that someone has died or whatever. Because what does that pet do? Do they talk back to you and give you advice and neat little platitudes? No, they just listen and they look at you with their big eyes and they wag their tail and they don't talk back. They don't give you advice. And so people who talk to their pets, I say that's wonderful. That's a neat thing to do because you're letting out the feelings, you're expressing it, you can hear yourself saying it, and you feel better after that process. The last thing, of course, is reaffirming life and hope and saying, yes, I hate this, I hate it, I hate it. Whatever it is you're going through, you hate it. But I'm going to go on, I'm going to affirm life, I'm going to say there are good things and I'm going to find them. Next thing we're going to talk about is the secondary griefs. You know, nothing just happens and it's over with, right? But there's all these additional things that add to the grief and compound the grief. It's not just that initial thing. So let's, for example, take death. What's the next thing you have to deal with in a secondary grief and death? The funeral. Now, I wrote a paper in college when I thought I was smart on how stupid funerals were. Now I'm a little older and a little smarter, and I know how important funerals are in saying goodbye and allowing the community to say goodbye and allowing the communities to support us when we're going through stuff like that. What's after the funeral?
A will.
I never thought about that one. Right. What else? Reading that and hearing this last person's testament. How about the insurance papers? How about the bills? What else? Belongings. What else?
Free time you didn't have.
Excuse me?
Free time you didn't have.
Free time. Okay, never thought of that one either.
I thought you would have spent with that person, but you don't have that person.
Okay, this person's gone. We were going to do this together. Okay.
It's even deeper than that. It's like sitting, it's like watching the clock turn to 5 o'clock. And expecting them to walk in the door, because that's the time you know that you grieve, and it may only be for a minute, but it's still that space of time that is so incredibly powerful that you no longer have.
And in connection with that, if you've been at a bedside for weeks,
yes.
And then all of a sudden
all
there's
all
that empty day.
Yes. And what do I do now with this time that I spent? Okay. Good. Very good. Anything else?
Dinner alone,
okay. Or anything alone. How about church? How about sitting in church alone when you've never sat in church alone for 45 years? What about the money situation? What if it's a death and all of a sudden I find out I don't have enough finances? This is what happened to my aunt at 55. She had to go out to find a job at 55 when she hadn't used these skills for 35 years. What if there's not enough money or my house burns down or there's a divorce and I have to move from the house that I've always lived in and all the memories are there? So I not only have to grieve the loss of this person, but the loss of now having to find my skills and get a job and move to an apartment with no view. What else?
The dreams.
Okay, dreams. We were going to retire together. I had dreams for my kid and now they're so messed up with drugs that I thought he was going to be a such and such or she was going to be, and now they're you know. Okay, what else?
Being now kind of single in your social life.
Okay, the fifth wheel. Where do I fit in with my friends? And so, okay, fifth wheel, good. What else?
Anniversary and birthday dates.
Holidays and anniversaries. Okay, right. we always had Christmas at so-and-so's house. So-and-so always carved the turkey. So-and-so was always here. Yeah. All those things have to change.
The other family members unresolved issues with whoever passed away.
Okay. Especially if she's, did you hear that? The unresolved family issues with the other members of the family. And especially if it's a sudden death. If we're at the bedside like she talked about and the person is able to talk with us, we're able to resolve stuff. We tell them that they love them. But what if the family members aren't there, there's been conflict, oh, the last words I said were horrible, or there's been conflict.
Not dead.
And they keep cropping up and saying, I'm not going to pay alimony anymore, and I'm not going to do this, and I'm not going to do that, and I want the kids for this holiday, and I, you know, all of this, and that person just keeps cropping up in one's lives, making the situation even more intolerable. Grief also brings up ultimate questions. What are some of the ultimate questions, the biggies that we don't like to deal with except when we're thrown into crisis? What are some of them?
Was it worth it all?
Excuse me?
Was it worth it all?
Was it worth it all? Meaning what?
Meaning if it's a spouse, was it worth getting married? Was it worth spending that time together? Was it worth walking down that aisle?
Because of the pain I feel now. Okay, okay. What else?
All the immortal life questions.
Right, go on with that.
Is there a heaven and is there a hell? If so, where is this person?
And am I going to see this person? Yeah.
Will I know them?
Will we know each other? Maybe it's a fetus that's died. Is that fetus in heaven? It never took a breath. What's it going to be like? Am I going to know my baby when I see it? We know much more now about the grief, and in a group this size, there's a whole bunch of families in here that experienced miscarriage or stillbirths. And years before, we just sort of said, well, you know, that's too bad, you'll have some more. Ooh. And now we realize how important that grief is in dealing with a child that maybe never even took a breath, but we carried them and we loved them and we conceived them. Okay, ultimate questions. What else? What other questions?
The questions of God, I think you mentioned that before with the gentleman saying, how did God let this happen?
Yeah, the questions of God. Who am I in relationship to God? Who was that person in relationship to God? Good, what else? What if I was Mrs. Paul Smith, and now I guess I'm Susan Smith, or whatever the case may be. Or both my parents have died, and now I'm nobody's daughter. You know, I'm the first generation, and how do I feel about that now? So it's our role and who we are. How about if you saw someone dying a long, slow, painful illness? Do you think about your own death? And am I going to die like that? Do I want a living will? Do I want a no coat on my body when I get so bad that I know I'm not going to get better? Who will take care of me? Sort of some of those issues of what am I going to do at the end of my life? So we're aware of our own death, too. The other thing I think in ultimate questions is, if Grandpa Smith just died, what do I tell my kids? How much do I tell a four-year-old? How much do I tell a seven-year-old? What terms do I use? How honestly do I handle this? That's one of the questions, too, is how much do we tell our kids and what way do we tell them? And society wants us to be well, right? If you're in grief, loss, in any of these, society really wants you to get well fast, please, because I don't know what to do with you if you aren't well. A survey was done about 15, maybe 20 years ago. People on the street. I'll never forget this survey. I hope people have learned in the last 20 years. It was out on the street. People went and said, how long should a person normally grieve who's lost a family member? That's how it was stated. The people gave the response of 2 weeks to 2 months. Now, obviously, this is an enlightened crowd because they go, oh my goodness. Anyone who's really been in grief, and who's honest with themselves, knows that after 2 months, you're finally sort of coming out of the shock of what this means. And you haven't even begun to really start healing yet. So how absurd that is. Chief Blackhawk, when his son was killed in an Indian war, blackened his face and separated himself from his village for 2 years and grieved the loss and death of his son. You know, in years gone by, what did we do to let people know that we were in grief? What did we wear? Black. And for a year, we wore black. And so, if you were in grief, I treated you like you were in grief because you were in black. And it was right before me that that's what I was supposed to do. And we don't do that today. And we say, oh, Fran, how are you doing? And Fran, his husband has just died 3 months ago, and Fran says, fine. And so how do we treat her? Fine, because we don't know what to do if she starts crying. And we've already heard the story 3 times. And we don't know what to do with her, and we don't know what to do with us. And we're in a hurry anyway, so we hope Fran says, fine.
It's worse for somebody who is divorcing, I think, because I'll be personal about this. I had a staff of 8 at one time, and 6 of them were divorcing at the same time. And the impact on the workload,
yes.
First of all, was tremendous.
And you became a counselor, didn't you?
Well, I sure did.
Yes, yes, of course.
But you don't wear a sign that says, you know, I'm stressed out, don't give me another job to do, or any of those kinds of things. And so the impact on the person's personal life, on the interaction with people in the workforce, rather than just in a social way, I think, that we haven't dealt with.
Right. Thank goodness some of that's coming out, and we're working, we have support groups, and that helps a great deal.
But you have to have an understanding employer to get to that.
Yes, you do. Somebody who's maybe been through it or else is very sensitive and empathetic. We got 3 choices. I'll just go over them quickly. We can give up, right? It's either fast suicide or slow suicide. And I see someone I'm working with in the hospital right now who is slowly committing suicide. She only drinks Pepsi and alcohol. She smokes and she only drinks junk food. And she's been in the hospital 6 times in 6 months. And 6 months ago, her husband died. She is killing herself. She's literally killing herself. The other thing you can do is sort of wing it. And that's, unfortunately, what we've done for so many years. We sort of grope through this, hoping that we kind of get through after time. And the last thing we can do is say, I hate this. I hate this, but I'm going to get through it, and I'm going to view this as a challenge, and I'm going to find the goodness in life, and I'm going to go on. Now, the 2 most important things I can tell you to do, and these are simplistic, but they are 2 important ones, is to cry and is to talk. I know a counselor who actually writes on a prescription pad and hands it to the people who come in her office, cry once a day. It's really important, and I think that's a good idea. When I was thinking about grief and loss and how it fit into the whole theme this summer of In the Image of God, I thought, does God cry and mourn and grieve?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I came up with, too.
For
yes, for his son. And I thought, if I want to know that, I guess I have to look at Jesus. If Jesus is, in fact, the mirror of God, if I want to know what Jesus did, I'd look at the scriptures. And what did Jesus do? He mourned for Lazarus. He mourned for John the Baptist. He wept over Jerusalem. He grieved in the Garden of Gethsemane. Yes, Jesus, in fact, mourned. And I think, therefore, God must mourn. And therefore, when we're in this process, I think we really are in the image of God. And that's kind of a blessing to know that God really isn't any different than we are and goes through this. And I think your point about he wept over the death of his son is a beautiful image of the fact that we are in the image of God as we go through this process. when I talked about crying and talking, telling that story again and again, talking about the feelings when we're in the middle of depression, when we're in the middle of anger, talking to someone who cares, you got to find someone who cares. If you can't find someone who cares, you find a professional, if you can't find a friend, I mean, or you get to a grief recovery group. If you don't have one, start one. A church is a wonderful place because you have that common bond of your Christian faith to hold you together. I'm going to quickly come to an end here. I got only 2 pages of notes left, and I'll let you talk. The thing I wanted to say about children, I thought of doing a whole session on this, and maybe we could, since it's not up on the board, but we could get together and talk about this, is when we are parents of children, small children, or teachers, how do we talk to kids about death, and what do we do with them when there's a funeral they need to go to? If we have time and you're interested, I'll get back to that. But I'm just going to say we talk to them honestly, and I said that maybe 25 minutes ago. We use terms they understand, we explain the situation, we cry with them, we affirm their tears and their sadness, and then, and this is really important, you say to little Johnny or Susie, you know, Grandpa died. What does that mean to you? And if the kid says, well, he went to the hospital and he was really sick and then he didn't come home and people die in hospitals, what's going to happen when he or she needs to go to the hospital to get their tonsils out? I don't want to go there because that's where people die. And so you, by asking them what they perceive this situation to be, we find out their misunderstandings, and hopefully then we can re-explain it again. Or if we heard that we lost Cousin Katie, as I said in the beginning, and they think, well, you know, you just go find them, I don't understand. The story that sticks in my mind, and I know you know this, is when little John Kennedy, his father was President Kennedy, and he goes back to the office after the whole funeral and this wonderful little thing where he salutes his father's casket, and he says to the secretary who's sitting there, well, when is my daddy coming back? Well, he didn't understand. Dead is dead, and dead means they're not coming back. So we ask them the question so we know what they're thinking and we can help them. When you're in grief, loss, any of these things are going to be affected. And it's important to know because we've got to understand our bodies. Number one, sleep. Of course, you already know this. You're either going to sleep too much because you're in depression or you're not going to be able to sleep enough because of the chaos that's going on in your head. You're either going to eat too much or you're going to not cook at all because you don't care anymore. Concentration. Can we concentrate when we're in the middle of any of this? No. We can't complete a task. We walk to do something and we can't even remember why we went in the room. We're accident prone. Oh, how many times there's been an automobile accident because someone has been in the process of thinking about that loved one or whatever and not concentrating, and therefore there's an automobile accident. Also, they have done studies, and here's three of them I'm going to name why it's so important. There are physiological changes that are going on in your body when you're in grief. The grief is stress, and the immune system is affected. The lymphocytes, which are the white blood cells, do not produce at a normal rate when you're under the stress of grief. The NK cells, which are called natural killer cells, are also affected by depression and loneliness, and they are the master regulators of the immune system. And number three, the endocrine system is affected. The adrenal gland, which secretes a chemical which depresses the immune system, is all screwed up. Also, your electrolytes, which is your needing of water and you're transferring all this stuff. You need more water when you're in grief. So we tell people, stay away from alcohol, stay away from caffeine, and drink a whole lot more water. Of course, you already know you're supposed to get exercise, you're supposed to eat right, all that sort of stuff. It's really important because your body really doesn't feel well when you're going through this stuff. And there's a physiological reason. It's not just up here, folks. It's really all through your body. Grief is like being plopped in the middle of Holden Cascade Wilderness up there in the hills. And what's the only way out of Lyman Lake? Walking, one foot in front of the other. Thanks. Getting out, plodding out. No one's going to helicopter you out of grief. It's one step at a time. As I said before, our lives are shattered when we're in this. And when we're going through the big griefs, we put it together. We just put it together differently, knowing and reconstructing it, knowing it's going to be different. I think, as my last statement, we as Christians have such a wonderful advantage to other folks. When I see non-Christians going through grief at the hospital, I'm amazed, whether it's the loss of their health or whatever it is they're going through. As was mentioned, I work with people with chronic illness and terminal illnesses. We as Christians know that we walk all through these processes with our hand in Christ's hand. And we have that faith and we have that belief in the hereafter to cling to. And you know that poem which is so often used about footprints when you're walking along. And in the really tough times, we know that all we have to do is say, Christ, I can't handle any of this and you'll have to carry me. And that's the bottom line, I think, that we as Christians have, is that we have that extra source of strength and power to plug into that unfortunately other folks don't have. Okay, questions, reactions. Actually, you know what? I did this. I didn't get done 45 minutes, so I'm really quite proud of myself that I talked so fast that I gave you time to talk and respond. Yeah?
I have a question between death and the funeral there. It has to do with your paper that you wrote when you knew everything.
Oh.
Because I thought I knew everything too, you know. When my parents died, they were
very... Can everybody hear? Talk loud.
I don't have to talk loud. My voice carries through. There was a funeral and the bodies were buried in a casket. Right. Now we're hearing that people should be cremated, and my husband and I have said in our wills that we will be cremated. I have just experienced the death of a dear friend who was cremated, and I feel robbed.
You didn't get to see
because
her.
Because I didn't get to see her dead. Mm-hmm. I worked with her all through her illness, but she died and they cremated her. Never started it, and somehow or another I feel cheated from the parking, and I don't know how other people feel about this, but I'm having second thoughts about what to do with my will.
What's the alternative to that?
Have
the funeral first, go ahead with the embalming and all that, the open casket, the visitation, and then cremation. I mean, that really solves both problems, even though it's more costly. Other things, reactions, comments.
I'm just feeling. My friend lost her husband real suddenly. She dropped him in the bathroom and she came downstairs and found him dead. They whisked him away and she never saw him again. And every time she went in that bathroom, she saw him dead. And then she lives through it. And it's been 7 years or something.
Now, why did she not see him again? So I mean,
because he was cremated. She saw him dead. But she didn't see him after that. She saw him in this horrible state.
You know, there is something to be said, and I think you've mentioned this, is seeing that person looking peaceful. You know, as much as I don't know how I feel about going to these visitations, to see that person that I visited in the hospital for 6 months getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and now I see them and how do they look? Peaceful. You know, and maybe I didn't get to see them the night they died in the hospital. Maybe I wasn't the chaplain on call. Though I think right after a person dies, they look peaceful. And even as they're dying, I think they look peaceful. But, you know, to see that person looking like okay is important. You're right. It's important.
And they don't have to be embalmed or peaceful?
Yeah, they don't have to be embalmed. If the family, but then the problem is, the immediate family may see someone. They all come to the hospital, you know, at the hospital we call everybody and they all come in. But what about if it's a friend who doesn't get called, you know, and then they don't get to see that person? I mean, we each have our own ideas about this, but the thing is we think about what I want in my funeral, but we forget what the needs of those who are left behind. And I see some people
not. That's my question. How about the people?
Maybe, do you have children?
Yes.
Maybe you need to say to your children, what do you need? What do you need? How do you need to say goodbye to me? And help them.
Right, and for grandchildren, it's even harder, especially if they're younger, than it is for children who might be older, or in my age group.
Saying goodbye, seeing the person, what?
Yeah. For the grandchildren in my age group, they need to see.
Yes.
That I've died or grandpa's died.
What I also thought that I was smart, which was several years ago, I'm really getting smarter and wisdom is coming to me finally. We had a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old and my husband's best friend's father died. And we didn't take them to the visitation and we sort of whisked them past the open casket into the church for the funeral. We took them to the funeral. This year, my sister's father-in-law died, and at 14 and 15, this was the first time that our children went to a visitation. They had never seen anyone dead before. Now, when this father-in-law died, I have a 5-year-old niece, and my sister came to me and said, this is your field, what should I do about this 5-year-old? And I said, you take her, you explain everything. She had been visiting her grandpa at the hospital. She had seen him with tubes, she had seen him with the feeding tube, she had seen him getting skinnier, she had seen him throw up, the whole thing, which I thought was really brave of my sister to keep bringing her through this process. I said, take her to the visitation, explain that he's dead, explain that she's going to see the body, et cetera, et cetera. I said, but you're not going to believe me because I'm just your sister. So I want you to go to your pastor, and I want you to go to the chaplain at the hospital where he died, and I want you to go to her preschool teacher, which happens to be the foremost authority in the Quad Cities, and I want you to ask those people to say this to you. Ask them what they think. Well, they all affirmed what I said, which was, take her. She's only 5, but take her. This is part of a learning process. What happened on a family farm when someone died? We all come from family farms, right, where so-and-so died, grandpa died. The women, what they do? They washed the body, and they got the clothes, and the men went out, and they made the coffin, and then he laid in state in the dining room, and everybody came, and we could see grandpa, and then we buried him out of the family plot. Well, we understood death a lot better. We didn't shelter people then. We just went ahead with the process because it was normal. And now we hold back from all that. So she did take my niece. And it was a neat thing because she looked at him, she wanted to touch him, and why doesn't he get up? And so all the questions she had could be raised right there. And if my sister wasn't there to answer the questions because she was in line, I was there to answer them. And it was, and you know, she went through that whole process. The only thing she didn't want to do was ride in the big black car. And I said, and her father wanted to take her, and I said, hey, if she doesn't want to do it, let her ride with me, you know, because she's gone through all this so naturally that let's not make her do something she doesn't want to do. There's a long answer to that. I'm sorry. Mary?
My siblings and I have been very curious about what could have been different in our childhood. My father died when I was 6. The children in the family were 9, 7, 6, 2, and 6 months. Each of us have discovered in adulthood, in very painful ways, what that death meant and what we did with it. And we each did something different. We all went to the funeral. I can't think of anything that people didn't do. I don't know. But my oldest sister talked off God. That somehow the death of father was the death of God, and she exited the church as fast as she could, and that was the end of that. My brother decided he was never going to grow up. If this is what happened when you grow up, I'm not growing up. I decided he wasn't dead, and I was 35 years old before I let him die. My younger sister spent her whole life looking for a father. She would crawl up on the lap of any man she ever saw. She fell in love with men that were 20 years older than she was. She was just this frantic little child looking for a father. My baby brother pretended he never had a father.
Which he almost did in 6 months.
Right? Yeah.
And how did your father die? Excuse me, did you say that?
Cancer.
Cancer. Long illness, pain,
no,
at home.
Well,
whisked away to the hospital.
No, he was home when he was sick a lot, and he died at home.
Did your mom talk about it? Did you talk about your dad? Did you share your grief? Did you cry together, talk?
I don't remember. So maybe not. I don't know. We talked a lot about him after that, in the sense of Daddy would not like to be doing those things.
Well, maybe that's part of the problem. We use daddy as a, you know, tool. Yeah, thank you. Tool. Poor daddy. He got a real short end of his finger. There's when it happens in childhood like that, there's so much we don't remember. And it's hard to go back. With something like that, maybe you need to sit down one-on-one and talk to somebody about, you know, as maybe some of your brothers, and you must have done at 35 when you decided to let him go.
Oh, yeah, okay, but it's all been very traumatic.
Yeah.
You know, and I've just been trying to think what might have been done. Or do children just do this sort of thing no matter what goes on? Whatever their need is, they just do.
Well, I think that we somehow also, the people around, shape and help. Do we help them with their needs when they're going through this, or do we say, oh, don't, let's not talk about this, and they come up with their own ideas of what happened.
And then if we're using dad as a tool to make us behave, dad doesn't look like such a good guy. You know, kind of scared. It's real, it's complex. I'm not answering your question, but.
Well, probably you're gonna
answer. Anything else? Yeah.
In your studies, in looking at cultures within the United States, what have been some of the better points in dealing with grief? I'm thinking of the Jewish with sitting Shiva and a big mm-hmm. Irish wake where there's mm-hmm. a lot of celebration that's talked right. about. What are some of the areas that you've come across?
Just those. There's just those. When people are willing to celebrate the life, and have those times where they sit down, some of the neatest things I've seen, when they sit down at a wake or at a visitation and share stories. Do you remember the time? And we share not only the sadness, but we share the joys of that person's. And some of the Jewish things where you have a year of mourning. In Orthodox Jewish faith, you have a year of mourning, and the things you do and the prayers you say, and that time is dedicated to that person. I think the two examples you gave are perfect, you know, sharing the good times and sharing the prayers, and those are two of the ethnic groups, I would say the Italians too, that let out those emotions and do a better job than we Scandinavians and Germans do.
You said something interesting before. You were talking about dealing with the grief. We've been talking a lot about death, and I think you mentioned crying as being one. You talked about talking about it as being very important. One of the things you listed is you talked about loss of a job. I remember very well my father losing it. Couldn't do that mm-hmm. because of the guilt involved. How do you... You're really embarrassed to talk to other people in many instances, especially 20 years ago, to talk about losing a job
yeah.
or being able to show that emotion of it. Mm-hmm. How does that differ on a situation like that? Even talking to people are very understanding, I think, when you're talking about death, especially children or a parent. People are willing to talk about that, and it's easy to have a lot of compassion. But how about some of the other areas? I use job as an example. There are probably some of the others that are maybe not as easy, or maybe people are not quite as compassionate about mm-hmm. that, or mm-hmm. willing to listen to some of those things.
I think one of the things I'd say in response to this, and you all heard it, I hope, sometimes it's too hard to talk to people we know, but it's a lot easier to talk to somebody we don't know. I go into a room in a hospital, a total stranger to somebody, and they'll tell me and open up to me things they would never tell to their spouse, to their daughter, to their son, whoever. I think in some of those instances, and in years back, it was harder to do that. And there weren't, I mean, now we have a support group for everything. So you can find a place where you can go and be kind of anonymous and share that. So I think talking to somebody who isn't part of the situation is sometimes a real help. Whether it's a professional, whether it's a minister, many times we know the minister, whether it's going to a mental health center and saying, I got to talk about this. But 20 years ago, or is that what you said? I mean, that was harder to do. And that's an issue, too, that not only are we in grief, but our ego's involved, right? I mean, we lose a job, and now our family has no income. Oh, you know, the embarrassment and the shame and the, I can't feed my own family, and what am I going to do, and we're going to lose. I mean, that happened to my grandfather, you know, during the Depression. They lost their job. He lost his house. You know, that's when he started drinking. So what do we do with that? Well, he chose not to handle it well. But saying, I'm going to see this as a challenge, and there must be some good, and I must be able to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I'm not sure I'm also answering that, but I think sometimes talking to somebody we don't know is helpful.
And Eugene, is it true, talking about men and job loss, I'd like to also just ask a question of you of retirement. I see my father coming up to his retirement, and I don't see him preparing for it at all. And I read once recently the horrifying statistic that the average age lived after retirement for a man is 8 months. Is that
okay? I have not heard that statistic. I have not heard that statistic.
It is, it's not a very nice
It's not thing. Helpful. It's not helpful. No, that's not helpful. But you're right. The people who are ready and saying, this is coming up, there's nothing I can do about it, I'm going to prepare myself, handle it a lot better. But what do we do with these people who refuse to do that? I mean, you can lead this horse to water, can you make him drink, sort of thing. You know, no. And sometimes it can't be the family member also. Just like I was saying over here, it has to be somebody else to say, okay, what are you going to do now? Or maybe like my own father, he had to go through the pain of saying, well, what do I do now? You know, and going through that, well, I've got all this time in my hands, what am I going to do? And then decide to take up some hobbies and do something and come to Holden and say, I have skills. The thing I've seen that's the neatest, and I just visited Sun City West in Arizona. What a community. You know, everybody volunteers for everything, and if you have all these people with all these skills, and they tap in, and people who are used to be teachers now tutor at this school, and somebody else teaches a class in art, and you take the skill that you've learned, maybe you're a tax person, and you go and help these people do their taxes. I mean, there are communities that have really worked hard in saying, this is a grief, this is a loss, but these are people with wonderful skills, and let's allow those people to use those. So there's creative ways of helping somebody do that, but they got to be willing to be helped. One more, and then I promised I would end the tape at 5.
I just wanted to mention, I know Granger Westberg had some wonderful books.
Yes,
also Rabbi Kushner, mm-hmm. and his When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
Right.
And he's got other books, and we've heard him lecture also, and he's excellent. Just excellent.
Rabbi Grohlman has an awful lot of really neat stuff, too, about handling children in death and how to talk to them. He's great for that. Yes.
I just wanted to ask what you do with chronic grief, a disabled child, a chronic illness, grief that doesn't end.
In our hospital, I know the tape is over, so goodbye, Dan. We have a support group for people who have chronic pain. You know, when you're in chronic pain or you have a child that has a disability, you think you're the only one in the world that has this because you see everybody else's kids running out and playing and going to school and going to...